Welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. It is our intention to continue offering these audio recordings free of charge. However, if you would like to donate to support our cause in keeping our facility open in Nashville, you can do so via the Venmo app by sending a donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can find us online at our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, and click the donate tab.
For my talk today, I've taken on the topic, the question of what is insight. You may hear a lot about insight meditation, Vipassana, and how it's related to mindfulness. But first, I want to check in on how to even listen. How to even hear this talk, how to even hear the Dharma, how to practice this quality of insight listening. You know, like, this situation probably looks really familiar. There's some sort of person sitting at the front of the classroom that seems to be some sort of authority on a subject while telling other people what to hear and know and think. And so therefore you can leave here having some sort of intellectual idea about what the authority on the subject thinks about things. It's almost like this, this privileged quality of knowing things. Like, you came here, you put the money in the bowl, like, I owe you something. I guess it is kind of my job to point you in certain directions and guide you in certain ways and say, look here, and you got to do the work. Don't believe something just because I said it. Go see for yourself. You know, there's a famous sutta that the Buddha taught, this thing called Ahipassika. There's the Kalama Sutta. The Kalamas were like a clan of people. They would have different spiritual leaders come and visit them in the time of the Buddha, and then the Buddha came and taught his Dharma. And one of the Kalamas was like, you know, we got all these teachers coming here, and they're saying they have the truth, they have the true way, and you're saying the same thing, why should we listen to you? And his response was, go see for yourself. Go see for yourself if this leads to awakening. Go see for yourself if this leads to an end of suffering. And so that's how this practice works. Go see for yourself. There's nothing really I can say to you that's going to really transmit any sort of genuine insight. It may point you in a direction, but you need to go that direction. You know, there's this analogy of pointing at the moon. When somebody points at the moon, so often we're looking at the finger, not at the fucking moon. We even look at the moon when somebody's pointing at the moon. So all I'm doing here is pointing at the moon. Look at the moon. And most of that stuff is just stuff in your life. Go see for yourself. Ahipassika is the term. Go see for yourself. And it's just the way we listen. We listen so much with our head. We want to listen with our ears. This beautiful thing that happens, that sound. I make vibrations in my throat, and then it creates these sound waves that we can't see, and it hits the ears. And then as it hits the ears, the head gets going, the mind starts going, and then that's how we communicate. Isn't that awesome? So, and then it goes into the body, and we start experiencing things in the body. So it's like, how much awareness do we want to put? We want to put some awareness into the body. I like putting awareness in the breath because it's a good tool to keep us grounded. We want to have awareness of the ears, and we do want to have awareness of the mind. And we want to have awareness external, internal, and external in both. Like, this practice of just listening has been a wonderful practice of mine. Because I am terrible at, like, interrupting people or telling people my opinions on things. And really, just the quality of listening to how words form in the throat is quite beautiful. I had this really tough teacher to begin with, begin my practice, and he would say the same things over and over again to me. And it's like, he says the same things over and over. And like he would say, and I go, I know. And he stopped me and he says, "What you really mean is fuck off." And it was true. I was like, "You said that, fuck off, fuck off, fuck off." I was saying, "I know." But really, man, you already said that. I really needed to hear it again. Because true hearing brings in something different than "I know." And so the way we hear these things, we put them into practice. We hear them, we fully know them, and then the insights happen. Because I do want to check in on what we value, too. Like, this consumer-based idea of learning that we value intellectualism. And the Buddha taught that wisdom, intellectualism is one of the near enemies of wisdom. And so you come to a class, you hear a teacher talk, and you get this, like, either a cliche that you can take home with you, or some sort of scientific concept, or some sort of old Buddhist concept. And then you can go and tell all your friends, and they'll be like, "Whoa, wow, that was a really interesting thing you said. You're so smart." And then it's like, they value you now. And really, it's just this, like, longing for love we have. It's like, what do you value in a relationship? And some of that is like, oh, I value smart people, and I want to be smart so I can be loved. And really, what about just love? What about being kind? What about being caring? That trumps intellectualism any day. If you can be kind to people, kind to yourself, clear with people, that trumps intellectualism any day. So it may get, when I talk about insight, it may get confusing on what's the difference. What's the difference between intellectualism and wisdom? And it's experience. You gain wisdom through experience. And I'm not talking about experience like you need to go travel the world to have every experience. All the experiences we need are inside of ourselves. The whole truth of the whole universe exists inside of this body. So when we sit and meditate, these truths reveal themselves. There's so much about the Buddha's teaching that science is catching up on. You know, there's like things like Buddha's brain and why Buddhism is true, that there's like this validation that science validates what the Buddha taught. And it's like, oh, how did he know 2,600 years ago that this is how the brain works, and this is how the mind works, and this is how the body works? He didn't have an fMRI machine back then. How did he ever know? Well, it's through his own experience. If you sit and look inward, the same laws of the whole universe are the same laws that the breath abides by. So specifically, what insight is really any of this understanding, this clear seeing, these experiences that decrease suffering. That's really what we talk about in Buddhist insight. It's an acknowledgement of this is how things work, now I'm suffering less. Or eliminating suffering altogether. So specifically, we look into these characteristics, these three characteristics: the characteristics of impermanence, the characteristics of suffering, and the characteristics of selflessness. So these three characteristics tend to be kind of crappy news, and it's a way to look for a higher happiness. These are the ways we fall asleep and try to find happiness, and then we get ourselves into trouble with these ways, and then therefore we suffer. So first truth, I mean, first characteristics of this is the characteristic of impermanence. And I like to say that all conditions are impermanent. All these things change. They shift. They're unreliable. So if our happiness is reliant on conditions, our own happiness will be impermanent. And that's why we want to see this clearly, that impermanence exists. The direct experience, we meditate, we spend some time on the breath, we calm the mind, and a good amount of tranquility arises. You know, there's so much emphasis on mindfulness-based stress reduction, and it's a wonderful way to calm ourselves and relax ourselves and set aside anxiety and all those things. And if you keep going, you'll wake up to a lot of truth. Or even in the instructions that it's a breathing in, you experience birth. Breathing out, you experience death. So even this breath has a birth, a life, and a death. And just even bringing up death, like, I was confronted with this characteristic of impermanence before I ever even started practicing Buddhism. It's a rude fucking awakening if you don't have the right tools. It's a rude fucking awakening anyway. But if you don't have the right tools to approach this truth of impermanence, it can be quite difficult. Like, I've had plenty of friends die. My own father died. Didn't know what to do with it. Thought it was incorrect. It was wrong. Death, something must have went wrong. But it's just the truth of life, just like this exhalation. So even on a surface level of impermanence, there can be just the simple insight. The simple insight of impermanence. What a beautiful thing. Things we don't like, they'll go away. Cool. You're in a difficult interaction with a difficult person. Let's say you work customer service somewhere, some situation that I know very well, and there's a difficult customer. They'll go away eventually. Okay. And then the other one, the thing you like, you're eating your ice cream cone, and you keep on eating it. It's going to go away. So this is why we have these practices of compassion for pain as it arises and appreciation for joy as it arises. It's very simple. The things you like will go away, and the things you don't like will go away as well. All things go away. So it gives us some relief here. And I think that's like a very simple understanding of impermanence. And sometimes I feel like this is misunderstood as when pain arises, some difficulty arises, we use impermanence as a mental strategy to hate whatever arises. This is not to be like, please, impermanence, show up right now because I'm in an unpleasant situation. And that's why sometimes I like to interchange the term impermanence with change. Everything changes. We are products of change. We are born of change. Get to know change. This body's aging. Everything is changed. So when something unpleasant arises, note the change of it. The first insight I had around this was an itch on my nose. I share this so much, and it's something so simple, but the change of this insight was so profound that I was sitting with a group of monks, very proper, so much older than me, so much more practiced than me, and very official, you know? And they were very still in their practice, and I had an itch on my nose, and I didn't want to be the only one just going like this when they were being very proper. And so what I did was note it. Oh, there's an itch on my nose, pain. And I got to know this itch on the nose. One noting, it will go away. It wasn't like, oh, please, impermanence, get rid of this itch. I noted the change of this. The itch on the nose started to change, and it started to come across the whole nose. And then it started to be like this feeling around the nose of kind of numbness. And so there was a point of pain here, but there was also numbness around the nose. And then there was also edges to the pain. And that changed too. And those shifted too. Sometimes it went out to my cheeks. Sometimes it went to the tip of my nose. And this is the way we want to note unpleasantness. We can learn from this unpleasantness. And you know what? Eventually, it went away completely. And this insight, that's like the insights that I'm talking about. Something so simple revealed the truth of all of things in life. My life changed after that experience. Very simple experience that I could otherwise go with. I just go like this, and I missed an opportunity for my life to be different. What I did was I sat with it, put the practice on it. My life was different from there on out. From there on out, things like that's, I quit drinking, I quit fighting, I quit a lot of things because I changed my relationship to pain by noting the differences that pain is, that pain has qualities to it rather than pain, wrong, bad, I check mark, I figured it out, I don't like pain. Well, I don't like pain is very obvious, keep going. What don't you like? And then even like urges, impulses. Impulses are no longer a reason to fight. Impulses are just another thing to note. I don't have to impulsively yell at somebody. I don't have to impulsively bury down my emotional pain. Don't have to impulsively reach for a drink. I can sit in that. And when it gets really bad, look at that too. Just like the urge. I don't know how many people are in recovery here, but just even early recovery of setting aside, for me, it was the drink. It was like the most intense fucking roller coaster ever and going on in my body. It's like, whoa, this is interesting. That's what's happening. And that had to I had to have that insight first about noting how pain changes until I got to the point to open up to the very intense feeling of quitting drinking and just even just the bodily changes, the emotional changes, and the impulses that come along with that, that this body has all of these things happening in it right now. Pretty amazing. Cool. I don't have to fight. And so that's the more deeper insight that it took me, personally took me. So that's what I want to say about impermanence. The next thing, suffering. Suffering. Yeah, like, what's the word dukkha? Dukkha, like the first noble truth, is generally where we begin in Buddhist practice, that this life is bound with suffering, that it isn't your fault, it doesn't mean you did anything wrong, it doesn't mean you did anything incorrect. Like I said, that coming to some sort of insights that happened before I was ready for them, like death of friends and family members, that I thought I was doing something wrong, that somewhere something went wrong because my dad died. And this truth acknowledged, no, birth, aging, sickness, death, sorrow, lamentation, grief will be around people we don't like, we'll be separated from people we love. It's going to happen in life. You don't have to fight. Doesn't mean it's wrong. It just happens. The fight gets us into trouble, which leads us to other forms of dukkha, viparinama dukkha and sankhara dukkha. Viparinama dukkha is the dukkha of clinging to impermanent conditions. And that's where I talk about this mind that thinks it's wrong and incorrect for my father to die. And I was suffering over that. And how many conditions we cling to that get us into trouble. Back to the phrase I like to say, that if our happiness is reliant on impermanent conditions, our happiness will be impermanent. So we go to a place of appreciating nice things as they arise without clinging. And then when things like back to my father's death, where I'm clinging on to that, I'm clinging onto that in multiple ways. I'm also, like, viparinama dukkha is the clinging to pleasant conditions. Sankhara dukkha is the clinging to unpleasant conditions.
Who would cling on to unpleasant conditions? Sadly, the majority of us. We have something called a conditioned response. You know, we go through some emotional heartbreak, and then we bury it down the best we can. And going back to the example I was using, drinking. I didn't want to feel any of that emotional pain of that emotional roller coaster I was going in because my heart was fucking broken. I can drink that shit down and bury it down. Done. Mission accomplished. Unfortunately, that ends up acting out in very harmful ways. So Sankara Dukkha, one, drinking is kind of an easy one. Two, we have these mental strategies we use too. We get very dismissive of our pain, very dismissive of what is worthy of our attention and what is unworthy of our attention. And so we want to bring in a certain amount of love. Just pointing back to love over and over again, that love for me is a certain amount of connection and security. And so we want to bring in self-love. Not just to the parts of us that we think are worthy of love, to the wholeness of our experience. So connecting with a sense of security to the parts of us that are unpleasant, whether they're emotional, physical, or mental. We don't want to develop a conditioned response to avoid the unpleasant qualities of life. And that just takes time. You know, it's like the uncovering of an onion sometimes to get down to the basement of the deepest sorrow. It's okay. It takes time. Just start where you're at and slowly peel away all the conditioned response of this Sankara Dukkha. So all things, all conditions are impermanent. This impermanent leads us to clinging. The clinging to impermanent conditions creates suffering. And then this third characteristic is something that may be a little bit a straight example of how intellectualism is limited, is this concept of not self. The concept that there isn't any sort of separate self, there isn't any sort of unique self involved in any of this, may be confusing. And that's why I point back to the experience of this. I don't know how many of you had this, but out of these three characteristics, the first one most people, when they start meditating, first have an insight with is this not self, with this no self. The experience of focusing on the breath and then having space from the mind, and then the mind comes back in, and then you see all of the wacky shit the mind says, that's the experience of not self. You go, oh, the mind has a mind of its own. The mind thinks these things without my own volition. It says all these things. And then you go, oh yeah, I'm not the mind. That's the insights I'm talking about. So just do that with everything and you'll be awake. Cool? But how many of you have that experience with the mind? Like you get space from the mind and you go, oh yeah, I thought I was the mind. I'm not. Cool. And then you start seeing the mind do the tricky things it does throughout life. The more mindfulness you have, the less self-identification you have with the mind. And our mind gets us into so much trouble. I don't think there has to be much philosophy around this concept of not-self. It's this actual practice of what do you self-identify with? And we're given these senses, this eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. Of the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind, which one do you have trouble with self-identifying with? Probably the mind. You know, normally I don't like self-identify with my nose, you know? It's like the smell, ooh, my smell. No, not really, it's just a smell. But fucking we do it with the thoughts, right? I hate that person. You know, it's like, oh no, just hatred's in the mind. It's not your hatred, it's just hatred. And I do want to go deeper into this and see how off of the deep end we can go with this fun concept of not-self. It's an anatta is the Pali word for it. When I go back into my beginning of my practice, when I was introduced to this concept, there was no chance of me even getting the opportunity to try to intellectually wrap my head around how there's not a unique, separate self. I started in Soto Zen, and we would chant the Heart Sutra. I don't know how many of you have heard the Heart Sutra. It's the most confusing fucking thing in the world. Sometimes I like to say that Zen is so good because they mind fuck you into practicing. If you try to figure stuff out, you're just going to get fucked. So I went and took one of the chanting books from the Soto Zen group that meets here, and I'll read the Heart Sutra out to you. And where I say this proper listening, you know, listen with the body, listen with the heart, listen with the ears. The mind will come in. It will naturally come in. It's just trying to embody what is being said. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when doing Prajnaparamita, clearly saw all the five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness. Emptiness itself is form. Sensation, perceptions, formations, and consciousness are also like this. Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither are increasing nor decreasing, neither defiled nor pure, neither increasing nor decreasing. Therefore, given emptiness, there is no form, no sensation, no perception, no formation, no consciousness, no eyes, no ears, no tongue, no body, no mind, no sight, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no realm of sight, no realm of mind consciousness. There is neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance, neither old age and death, neither extinction of old age and death, no suffering, no cause of suffering, no sensation of suffering, no path, no knowledge, no attainment, with no thing to attain, a bodhisattva realized the Prajnaparamita, and thus the mind is without hindrance. Without hindrance, there is no fear. Far beyond all delusion, nirvana is already here. All Buddhas of past, present, and future rely on the Prajnaparamita and thereby attain unsurpassable, complete, perfect enlightenment. Therefore, know that the Prajnaparamita, as the great miraculous mantra, the great bright mantra, the supreme mantra, the incomparable mantra, which removes all suffering, and this is true, not false. Therefore, we proclaim Prajnaparamita that says, Gate, Gate, Parasamgate, Parasamgate, Bodhisattva. That last part is kind of like, I love you, keep going. That Gate, Gate, Parasamgate. So you got it? Sorry, I stumbled a lot because it's a different translation than I used to chant. So I tried to jump into this. So the first part of this that I love, that form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Form is precisely emptiness, emptiness is precisely form. And what this is referring to is what the Buddha taught as the five aggregates. So something like, oh, there's no self. What do you immediately think? No shit, there's a self. I'm right here. Like, you're right there. Obviously, there's a self. The idea of the self is made up of bundles of these creations of form, feeling, perceptions, mental inclinations, and consciousness. This is what creates this thing that we call us, call me, call mind. And so what happens is, how do we create this self? One, form. Form. So something like form. Let's use sound. where I talked about the formation of vibration in my throat is going into this invisible thing in the air, and it hits the ears, and therefore the consciousness of thinking arises. So form, the first aggregate of form. Experience that. What's using sound? Form, experience that. Okay. Contact happened there. The contact of sound hitting the ears. Feeling is next. So feeling in this is Vedana. Some of you may know this from mindfulness. The second foundation of mindfulness is this feeling. And we use three categories to acknowledge feeling. It's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So form, contact, has feeling. So do that. Is that pleasant, unpleasant, or neither? Okay. The form of sound has a feeling tone. And then perception. What is being perceived? This is the mental knowing of what I'm hearing. So, form, feeling, perception. Can you put those together just for a moment? Okay. Form, sound hits the ears, feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Perception, car, AC, stuff like that. Mental inclination. It's what we think about it. Something like car. I think about a car. A vision of a car arises in my mind because I know what a car is. It's this thing called nama rupa. Nama rupa. Rupa is form, nama, name. So anything that enters our experience, we normally have this nama rupa. We've named the form. We project so much experience onto this because we use categories in the mind. You know, that even like Don. Don, I know Don. Don is person. Don is another construct, a dude. With what, this is a beard, you know, like, and I already have all these things that I named with language of knowing. Clock, of wall, of gray, of, I don't know what that is, an exit sign, you know. So we name things in certain ways. And when we name things in certain ways, we have stories about those things. Clock, it's this time. Exit, that's where I leave. And so that's where the mind goes. Form, feeling, perceptions, that's the mental inclination. So take time to do that. Let's just do that with sound. Sound, the form of sound hitting the ears, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. What is it, and what do you think about it? And this brings us to consciousness. This is the consciousness of knowing. This is the consciousness of who I am, that sound is car. Car is separate from me. I am born in this moment as self. That is just a construct. These are just constructs from these six senses: eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. Where that sutra talks about no ears, no tongue, no, you know, the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. It's not that, and it is that. So, things like sound, we spent time looking at sound. If you did not have ears, would you have hearing consciousness? If you didn't have eyes, would you have sight consciousness? Yeah. Tongue, taste? No. Smell? No nose, no smell. Back to the mind. The mind is tricky. If you didn't have mind, no mind consciousness. So we are just built on these aggregates of what creates us. The contact from these senses creates a feeling, perception, mental inclination, and a consciousness of self. And I love the looks. You know, you guys are giving me looks like, I think you're on to something. Maybe, you know? Maybe I am. I don't know. If I fully realized this, I'd probably be really fucking awake. But this is the direction we go in. Look at this. This is what creates a lot of this self, that creates a lot of clinging, that creates a lot of suffering. Know the truth of this contact. And that's why in the meditation I use noting. Noting when sound. Thinking. Sight. You know? It's just the contact of the arising. So insight comes from this, and really just me talking about it or reading a sutra isn't going to bring us to this place of clear seeing. You hear this now, and then you go into the world and go, oh yeah, that's a pleasant contact. I am clinging to that. Or I'm talking to somebody. I created this whole story of projection about this person without even knowing anything. And it's this becoming. So, how is this lesson suffering? It is... Let me read something, too. What the Buddha taught as the gratification, the danger, and the escape. Before my enlightenment, while I was still a bodhisattva, it occurred to me, what is the gratification in the world? What is the danger in the world? And what is the escape from the world? Then it occurred to me, whatever pleasure and joy there is in the world, this is the gratification of the world. The world is impermanent, bound up with suffering, and subject to change. This is the danger of the world. The removal and abandoning of desire and lust for the world is the escape from the world. So first thing, there is gratification. There are nice things in the world. They arise. That's the gratification of the world. It's nice. But the danger is they are impermanent, bound with suffering, and subject to change. So that's the danger. When we notice the gratification of the world, we want to note it. That's nice things. When we cling on to them or fight them, that's the danger. The escape is the abandoning of desire and lust for the world. Letting go of the reactive nature that leads to suffering. The clinging to the pleasant experiences. The clinging to unpleasant experiences. Clinging to the sense desires. When we note eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind, or the birth of this self, we can note when we eat something nice, we note that is taste. It's barely an involvement of, or there is no involvement of who I am as the taster. It is just the arising of taste. Pleasant. Oh, I'm eating ice cream. I remember that time I ate ice cream when I was younger. And then there's birth of consciousness. We watch all this stuff happen and unfold. Simplify. Let me simplify this. So we have at least a takeaway. It's the elimination of greed, hatred, and delusion. When we take refuge in the impermanent conditions of life, as they go away, that we suffer. We find a higher happiness. A higher happiness in one, in this teaching, in the Dharma. And then another higher happiness as we take refuge in the Buddha, this awakened nature, this trust that there is an unworldly pleasantness that goes beyond all of the sense pleasure and it goes quite deeper. And then when we find we take refuge in the impermanent, unsatisfactory conditions of life, we fall into greed, hatred, and delusion. The hatred is the chasing. The hatred is that something is unpleasant in my experience, and I gotta push it out of here in order to be okay. So my sense of well-being is reliant on this not being here, rather than finding a sense of well-being that is okay even when painful experiences are here. So it's this pushing out, and how often do we push out experience and try to manipulate experience in order to attempt to find a well-being that is conditional? finding the unconditioned as a way to rest in an unconditional sense of well-being that isn't reliant on things going our way. And so we have hatred as one, I'm pushing out experience. Greed is I'm reaching for experience. Grasping. That what where I'm at right now is not okay. I gotta get something in this experience in order for it to be okay. And then delusion. I want to cover this one, and then we'll go into how this actually works in the mind. Delusion is a tricky one because it really has a lot of flavor of this false beliefs. It's when we fall for this this belief that I can find lasting happiness in things that don't last. If only this. If only I had this, then I'd be happy. If only I had that, then I'd be happy. If only this went my way, then I'd be happy. You know how many times in meditation you sit down and your mind says that to you? If it's anything like mine, it's all the fucking time. Oh yeah, if this went my way, I would be totally great in this meditation. Go, oh, the mind is just in delusion. So it's greed, hatred, and delusion. We sit in meditation, and it's not this moral failing. It's just what the mind does. The mind is functioning on that pattern. It's some old hardware we got on going on here, so we want to know this old hardware. That we sit down, sit, pain arises in the leg, I hate it. Oh, hatred arises in the mind. I sit down, I need something, I'm hungry, I need something nice to eat. Oh, greed. Greed. Oh yeah, if I had that, I'm pretty sure I know I'd be happy forever. Delusion. Yeah, this is how this mind works. So when we fall asleep, so on whatever level this talk has expressed itself to you, you know, don't go chase an insight. Just let it rest. You'll just keep coming back here. You'll hear some wacky stuff, and then eventually it'll start showing up in your day-to-day life, like a little piece by piece. So going back into this, like, check into that entitlement that, like, I don't understand this. I must be wrong, or he must be not explaining this properly, or, you know, something's wrong because I don't intellectually understand this. You'll have an experience, and you go, oh, okay, I get it now. And then hopefully, like I said, with my experience of the things that are impermanent happening to my nose, something so simple, hopefully this changes your life for the better that you don't suffer. So we got a few minutes. If anybody has any questions or comments, I would encourage them. So thank you.